So there's a specific pipeline issue here that is something different that's happening in other places. And
it's not just government in the U.S. I mean, you could look at the military, airplane pilots, corporate CEOs, all those kinds of things in America, and then add the international comparison.
Right.
It's because the U.S. doesn't have paid maternity leave.
There's
a lot of women who have babies, and trying to juggle all of that is very difficult, and it's very stressful. And I think a lot of people, through no fault of their own, decide that it's too much. I'm going to focus on my kids. And I think it's a shame that people feel like they have to leave the workforce in order to provide that balance. But I think that has a huge part of what it is. And it's,
I think we could find that.
The system doesn't let you be a mom. Yeah. It's really a big problem.
There must be a correlation there, don't you think, Bev? The correlation
legislation like family leave policy. This is all very relatively new thinking to this country. We have a long way to go. But certainly, there's like work-life balance and mentoring, as I said before, in the history of this country, these are new words and new concerns that were just coalescing around.
When I plan a podcast, my hope is that guests will be willing to share their life experiences. This is not an easy thing to do. Today we hear so much about being authentic, but what does that mean exactly? It is not easy to take our professional cloak off, so to speak. Decades ago, I wrote a mission statement for my work. I wrote down, "Help people bring their whole selves to work." I put it in a drawer next to my bed because I wanted to think about it when I was in a contemplative mode, not when I was sitting at my desk, staring at mounds of project work. Mind you, I had no idea what it really meant. I mean, I had finally figured out the whole compartmentalization thing. Why would I think it's a good idea to bring our whole selves to work? I didn't know, but I knew something was in that statement. I remember talking to Jim Martin, a township manager in Lancaster County, about this idea. I saw a wood carving in his office that he had made, and I shared that I liked paint. I mused that work would be so much better if we could bring our creativity and ideas to it. To my utter surprise, he took me seriously. He told me that any time I wanted to run workshops on bringing your whole self to work, he would help me host it at one of the cabin-type structures in their parks that they use for meetings. Evidently, I was not the only one thinking about that mission. Today, it is more like a movement. To be honest, today I'm not any clearer on what it means exactly. I only know I have not stopped thinking about it. I observe the changing mores and culture in the workplace, and I'm curious about what is working or not working. But I propose that the growing inclusion of women in leadership is helping us to recognize the importance of the whole self. I think we are slowly changing the way we think about leadership. We have been talking about it for a long time, but I see real signs of change, and women are here for it. Today on the podcast, I have 5 articulate women guests. Together, they represent different generations and different experiences of work. They share how early life experiences have formed their ideas of leadership. They talk about the importance of support in their environments, and in particular, what it means to have other women and men pave the road ahead. We close the show with thoughts about conversations we need to have with men and other women. I think the last 10 minutes of this show offers clues to where we want to take this conversation next. Will you be a part of it? So let's get down to it. My guests today include Dr. Beverly Ziegler, Professor Emerita from Penn State. She has been on this podcast before, and we are always lucky to have her. Amy Farkas is Township Manager at Harris Township in the Center County region and is the new past president of APMM. Centrice Martin is Manager of Ferguson Township, also in Center County region, and is also advisor to this pioneering change community. Nicole Beckett is a local government advocate and Associate Director for Public Service at the Minor Center at Lafayette College. And Aaron Trone is Assistant Township Manager at Allen Township in Cumberland County and also serves as an advisor to the Pioneering Change community. I am your host, Nancy Hess, and I created the PCC Local Time podcast to start conversations among friends and colleagues in this professional field we call local government. And one last note, I start today's show off by asking my guests about early life experiences that they look back on and now recognize as early signs of leadership. Erin starts us off. Since our conversation includes five women, I will interject with a few cues about who is talking, at least until everybody has had a chance to speak. And also note, Nicole in this episode is recovering from a cold, so she'll be easy to pick out. But for those of you who know her, she may not sound like herself. Okay, so here's Erin.
Sure. So I don't know that I have a specific one. I guess sometimes I think of leadership as, you know, I think of myself as a reluctant leader. I feel like my desire isn't to lead, it's to maybe do, or I want to see things change, or I want to see something happen. And then nobody else jumps into the role. And so then I feel like I do. I felt that way just doing group work back at school. It was, who is the person who's going to pull all the people together, set the times, organize the meetings. Okay, send me your piece. I'm going to edit it down. I'll pull it into one paper. It always just ended up being me, and I always felt comfortable doing that. So I guess that was maybe kind of the early signs, but I never looked at that as a sign of leadership. I just always looked at it as what you got to do.
I want to ask you, Erin, like, when I hear you say that, there is a part of that is just being very helpful, having taught classes. I know that that student that wants to step up and be very helpful. But I also heard you say you had an idea that you wanted to actually like put into place. Like when you think back on your idea to help pull things together, do you think you were motivated by the desire to help or motivated by the desire to put into action something that you were thinking about that you want the group to move towards, or filling a void, or all of that?
All of that. And then I guess too, my mom was a vice president of a company. And so the conversation around the dinner table often was, these people weren't doing it. They weren't getting it done. I had to go here. I got to hop on a plane. This person's on an action plan. So there was, I guess, a real natural of like, you just do what you got to do to make it happen. And so that, I guess, kind of always stuck with me.
Amy?
So I have some follow-up to that. And kind of similar to Erin, when I was in high school, I wanted to be a reporter. And so I was the editor of our high school newspaper in Hershey High, the broadcaster. And I remember telling my parents distinctly when I was like 15 years old that I was going to go to Penn State, I was going to be a reporter, and I was going to affect positive change in the world. Because I was just flabbergasted at things I was seeing at the age of 15 in the early 90s. And so when I went to Penn State, that was my mindset. I was going to get out and I was going to be a reporter and I was going to do all the things. And I got out and I was a reporter in Elizabethtown, Lancaster County for 7 months right out of college. And there was a gentleman on the school board at the time who put forth a pro-family resolution that a family was one woman and one man. And Elizabethtown got some national coverage. And then in the middle of all of that, I fell into local government quite literally when the borough of E-Town called me and said, hey, you want to come work for us? And I found what my true path was then, because I realized I could affect positive change better on this side of things. And I'm very passionate about local government, and getting local government is the best form of government and getting people involved in it. So that was my vehicle. But much like Erin, I was always the one that was like, I got to do it. Like no one else is doing it, so I'm just going to do it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And so reporting has a whole nother idea. Like you're forming this idea where this is interesting to me. You have to not like get too far out in front of it. You have to sort of be there where you're thinking about the question.
Yep. Yeah. And you have to know, just like local government, right? You have to know a lot about a lot of different things as a reporter. Because when you go to cover a town or a community or an event that's going on, you have to know what you're covering. You have to come in and speak with those people and understand what they're doing. And it's a lot like local government. Like I think in local government, my first manager, Pete Whipple in Elizabethtown, said to me, oh, being in local government and being a manager is like being an ER doctor. You've got to know a lot of things about a lot of different things, and you have to be able to triage and work on those things a little bit at a time. So I think it's a very similar skill set in terms of the reporter and the municipal manager.
It's wonderful. I love that. What other thoughts do you all have?
What about you, Centris?
Well, I'll just inject with a very different perspective because this is what I do, right? I love working as a public servant in local government, but I also like changing the narrative a little bit. So my response is going to be a little different than Aaron and Amy's. And I'll just point it with this concept that overcoming adversity really is what helped build my character over time. And that the difficulty and challenges that I faced as a child and really just moving from Austin, Texas at the age of 12 to central Pennsylvania in itself was a level of adversity, but also just being raised by a single parent, working within a low-income family with those levels of constraints and overcoming that level of adversity positioned me to want to work really hard to figure out how you can change that path forward. And so I find myself looking back and I think not having experiences otherwise, this really has helped shape me and be able to build those levels of characteristics and leadership traits that allow me to manage, I think, with that level of empathy, but also with that goal-oriented mindset.
Yeah, I'm going to inject here just a little bit from my own thoughts on this because I want to just maybe trigger some other thoughts in you. Like I go back even to the playground when I was a kid.
Right.
And you said the word empathy. And I think the thing that stands out in my mind is I was the one who went out on the playground and would notice like who wasn't being included or if somebody was getting bullied. And I think the teachers noticed that I wasn't a follower, that I was somebody who would say that really wasn't a very nice thing to do. Or I would just take somebody under my wing. And so I was put in charge very early. So the childhood, even those character traits in childhood, I think sometimes show up. And Nicole or Beth, any thoughts on this?
I could jump in. I can't think of a specific experience, but I thought about this question a lot in the way that I was brought up. My grandparents spent a lot of time with me. They raised me pretty much. And my grandmother, when I look back today and I think about her, she's very bold, very intelligent, and they pushed me and made it that I could be the best that I could be. They wanted that for me. I never really knew what leadership was. I never saw the leader myself until now, as when I'm looking back and I know what leadership is. So I think it's just dealing with big personalities in my family and the way that they guided me helped guide my entire path. And I also had a lot of that knowing what not to do because of other family experiences, I didn't want to be that way. So I think that adversity also comes into play. In my life, I had both sides of it. I had role models that were just influential in creating a leader and then a lot of learning of what not to do.
I'm from a whole different generation, obviously, maybe several back to the dinosaur era, and also have been a professor. So it's really an independent life. You do what you want to do with whom you want to do it. And you do the teaching, the research, and the service. And in the service area, that's where you can do all kinds of leadership. But for me, I'm actually first generation high school in my family. And way back then, it was unheard of for a woman to go to college. And there was no such thing as a mentor. I never heard the words life, work-life balance or anything like that. And what it was for me is I obviously never sat around and thought about leadership, but a couple of things happened. One, I grew up directly across the street from a volunteer fire department. So I used to hang out there and learn about volunteerism and helping people. And then I think, secondly, I had a lot of uncles that were in the service and used to tell stories about all their patriotism and war stories. So I learned more about the helping professions. And then the big one was John F. Kennedy's inaugural address. And when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And that sealed it for me. And if you see my wall, the bottom of one frame there that's in blue, that's Kennedy's address. And so I just got booked on helping others. And that's how I ended up in political science and public administration and public service. And when you fall into all those kinds of things, you pretty much had Aaron's experience of you ended up in an organization and things needed to be done. And you kind of ended up being the leader. I always thought that the person who stepped out of the room for a few minutes comes back and they say, congratulations, you're the president. That's why I was asked to do a lot of things in life. So that's where I'm from.
Yeah. This is really quite a variety of background. And I really am glad that we could share this about each other. I think the next question is closely related, but it's more specific about gender. And maybe Amy could start with this question. And it has more specifically to do whether we noticed differences in the way we experience gender at any particular stage. And maybe this wasn't on our minds until a certain point in life. And I'm kind of curious how we experience gender through school, or at what point we said, there's some differences here.
Yeah. So when I was in third grade, which was back in the 80s, I told my teacher that I wanted to be president. And my teacher said, that's great, but you can't because you're a woman, because you're a girl. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, I don't understand why I can't be president. I can do all the things that the boys can do. And I come from a background of very strong females. My grandmother was married to my mom's father, who was killed in World War II when my mom was 5.5 weeks old, and moved my mom and her back across the country and got a job in the 1940s and had to work her way into everything that she had. And my mom is a very strong-willed person. And I also remember around the same time frame, my mom had a credit card and she tried to close the credit card and they told her she had to have my dad's permission to do it. And it was pretty clear in the discussions that my mom and I had in our house was, you never let anybody make you feel small because of who you are. So a lot of that experience shaped as I moved on in the world. I mean, obviously, we're all in a very male-dominated field now. I worked in recycling for a time, which is a very female-dominated field, and completely different experience, right? Because you walk into the room there and you don't have to be the smartest person in the room or the most well-spoken person in the room because everyone accepts you for who you are. And I feel like sometimes in local government, if you're the woman in the room, and for a long time, I was the only female manager in the center region. And I would get told, oh, you're a little too direct. Your email came across as being a little too bitchy. And I'm like, well, but you're not telling that to the other men. Like, I get their emails and they're written the exact same way. But as a woman, you get told you're a little too this, you're a little too that, and you have to be the most well-spoken person in the room, the smartest person in the room. I'm sure we've all had the experience of, when I started working in the township here, and an older gentleman who came in and said I couldn't fix a problem because I was a woman. And I turned around and said, well, that's really rude. And I'm not going to help you if you don't start talking to me better. And he goes, oh, you're right. I'm sorry. But it's not my gender doesn't make me capable of doing my job, right? It's what's inside my brain that makes me capable of doing my job. And I wish more people would look at that and realize that, because I have a niece who's 18 years old. My niece is going to set the world on fire. She wants to be a marine biologist. She's the smartest kid I know. She's gotten herself into all of these programs. And she just refuses. She refuses to let anybody make her feel less than, because she's going to go out and she's going to do what she wants to do. And that makes me, makes the 8-year-old of me so happy to see that. No one should ever be told you're less than because of your gender, ever.
Yeah. Truly, just it's true of Bev too. Both of you and your own generation were just at the cutting edge in the sense of being leading, taking on the role that was largely occupied by males. It's very interesting. And what other experiences have you all had that made you think about gender differences in your life?
I could jump in on this more so, not so much in the early days, but starting my career. I entered the field at the age of 21. I was a temp. It was new. I fell into a township. And I remember going to the first PSAV conference. So I'm like 21 or 22 years old, and I'm a young woman. There was nobody else like me there. I remember looking around and just thinking, like, what is this world? It's a lot of older men. What is this world? And there was nobody at that time who was inviting to me. There was no welcome. There was nobody who would even attempt to even have a conversation with me. So I think about that experience. And then when I took my role as manager, I was 30 years old. I was the first female manager in the borough. In county, for that matter. And from that day until the day I left, it was really repetitive that I would have people come into my office and say, can I please see the manager? Just automatically assuming that I was the secretary or whatever. And that was always an assumption, and it would continuously happen. Can I see the manager? And then when I say it's me, or I am the manager and introduce myself, the reaction that you would get was always very similar. It was always an, oh, you're not the typical face that we would deal with. You're not the typical person that we would deal with. So I really saw it in my career more so than anything. And I've also, I think personally, the passion that we have for our careers or the passion that we have as women, that passion has been very intimidating to a lot of the men in my life. And I think it takes a special person to be able to handle someone who carries that big personality and those traits. I look back now and I think about even personally, that passion, it stirs something up. And I think being a woman, yeah, it could be intimidating.
Yeah. That really like sends goosebumps on my skin when you say that, Nicole. I resonate. Yeah. I know you've got some other thoughts on this.
I could give a whole bunch of.
I know. That's why I'm afraid we're all going back.
Cross them out. I think I first became aware of gender when I was maybe junior high and high school with various offices. Like I could be the president of the Honor Society. I was the valedictorian because those were things that they couldn't take that away from you. You had the grade point and you're the valedictorian, but I could not be president of the class. You had to be the secretary of the class. And that was that way even in college. You could be the secretary, but not the president. That's the way women were. But even for me, it was whether you go to college in the first place. Girls were supposed to get married and have kids and not go to college by and large. But another thing that I think is really significant is there was no Title IX when I was growing up. And so when I was in high school, we had what was called Sports Day. And that was three times a year we played volleyball with another local high school that they bused in. And that was it for women's sports. And you can't miss the contrast when you go to the football and the basketball games. And another one is, like Amy said, she was the only woman for, well, I think as a professor, it's hard to believe I've taught at five institutions. And for all of those places, I was the only woman on the faculty until my last place, Penn State. It was 8 years before there was another woman on the program faculty. And it totally different. I would walk into faculty meetings and they would be following up conversations. And I didn't know what they were talking about until I figured out that they had their meetings in the men's room and settled things and made decisions and then followed up at the regular meeting. Another thing on the faculty, and that wasn't just me, as the only woman. After we had one or two women, we used to trade stories and we all had the same experiences. But for me, another big thing that hit home was salary discrimination. When I taught at North Carolina State University, after that was the third place that I taught at, out of the blue one day, the dean of the school, and it was large, hundreds of students and faculty, called me into his office. I had no idea. It's so big in those big universities, you don't really know the dean very well. And he said he was looking at salary and he wanted to give me a 17% immediate salary increase in my base salary, not the merit, but the base. And so this was a really nice man, but how in the world did I need a 17% increase? It's because I didn't get what I should have gotten when I was higher and for a year or two. And I could tell you other stories. I had a school director tell me I was not going to get much salary increase because I was from a two-income family. It's illegal, but I'm not the litigious type. I had others tell me you're not going to get much of a salary increase, no matter what your merit, because you don't have children.
Yes.
And this is actually more recent than you would think. Okay, not in the ancient days. And then a final thing is just marriage in general. I can say that to this day, and having taught at five institutions, most of my female colleagues, when I finally got them, were either single or divorced. It's really hard to work out the work-life balance and need support systems and all that. So I've been married 52 years. My husband and I don't have children, but I can't imagine how a married colleague with kids could get it all done.
Yeah.
So it's interesting you say that because Stephanie Tioli-Cools, who's the manager down in Bucks County, she was in Elizabethtown before me. So Stephanie and I are friends. So Stephanie told me when she had her first son, she went back to work 2 weeks after giving birth to deliver her budget to her board. And she said, I couldn't button my skirt because I had had a C-section and I was still recovering. And she said, I walked in and I presented my budget and I walked out and I was exhausted. But she said, I did it because I didn't want them to think I couldn't do it just because I had a child and I was a woman. And that was like not that long ago. That was probably early 2000s that she did that. And I just think I'm so grateful that we have these conversations about work-life balance now. And now I talk with Sandra Zedell, who's down in Montgomery County. And Sandra has an all-female board, and they yell at her if she responds to an email on the weekend. They want her to have a work-life balance. It's changing so much, but it's still so recent that it's just now changing, that it's like...
Is anybody else a mother? Okay. So you are. I knew when I'm older, and I'm in my 40s, and she was born right at the time of my 40s, and that has changed my perspective so much. Especially going 40 years without having a child and then having one later in life, it has changed a lot of my perspectives. It's just amazing to me to see how a little person could have such innate traits.
Mm-hmm. I think about how some of those traits get snuffed out. And that is my story, again, going back in my earlier life. And this was so profound for me. And I'm not sure other women relate to it as much as I do. And maybe I just needed it. I grew up in a family with brothers, but I went to a woman's college. So I get there, and this was my junior year. I transferred there. This was Goucher. I will never forget, I started to compete. It wasn't a conscious thing. All I know is I became like an animal. I was like, I was going to get the best grades. I was in the class bringing up subjects. I'm like, why now? And I realized I had been socialized to not compete. There was something that happened earlier in my life, in my family, in the school system, which basically said, tamp it down. And which is why, Nicole, that comment of you is so important, you know, that there has to be somewhere in yourself or in your environment that says, go for it.
And don't you love that today, that's the message that's being put out to the next generation? Like, that's the message to these kids. They are allowed to be who they want to be.
Yeah.
Or allowed to show their big personalities. Because I feel like that all the time. Even now, it's like, sometimes I feel like I just have to take it down a notch. Because it's not okay to have this much of a personality, Amy Farkas.
No, don't ever take that down a notch. I lived my whole life not taking my personality down. When I was 5, my mom would find me dancing in the middle of the mall on the stage by myself, because that's me. But yeah, no, and I would say to all of you, and Centrice, I know some of her kids through her social media, I haven't met them in person, but she's raising these amazing people, right? And you're all raising these amazing people. And I look now at what's going on in the world. And I was just talking to my college roommates about Gen Z and how Gen Z is going to save the world from everybody else. And I'm convinced of that. And that's wonderful. And I was fortunate. I grew up with parents who didn't tell me I was too much, even though I was always a little too much, but they were never like, Amy, you got to knock it back. And I think for every little girl that heard they were too much, you need to have the ones that are supporting them going, no, do you have that big personality? Because I always tell people, I can't tamper who I am. I have a large personality that's literally born into me. I can't change it. The pandemic tried me. I was talking to walls in my house because I was talking to my dog too much. He's ready to move out. But like being able to support people and encourage people to develop that. And I think that's one of the things in local government and one of the impediments to getting more women into local government, right, is that they think we all have to be these very buttoned up, staid men that just don't express opinions. We were on, Centrice might remember this, we were on a call a couple weeks ago about something going on in the region. And I was just myself. I was just on my soapbox and just saying all this stuff. And then I realized, like, the other managers were like, what are you doing? Like, calm down. And I thought about it, calmed down. I said, okay, let's do this. And the manager in College Township said, you went from like 0 to 100 and then back down to 0. And the management state college goes, well, that's Amy. That's why we love her. Like, that's what she does. And you need that to balance out the rest of them that are not that excitable. I like being the excitable one.
Yeah, for what it's worth, when I was young, I read a quote by Theodore Roosevelt, President Teddy Roosevelt, that said life should be led like a cavalry charge. So it sounds like you, Amy. And I, somehow that had an effect on me. I've always remembered that. I used to keep it on my desk when I was in college, actually. It's a real
Amy, you're talking. Like, I remember the first time I saw you speak. It was a long time ago. And I was just like, wow. And then I met Stephanie Tioli. And I was like, wow, it's okay to be this way. It's okay to let it shine.
Yeah. And with APMM, I was the sixth female president of APMM, and I was president last year. And APMM's been around 100 plus years. So when Stephanie Mason was president, she was getting to be anointed president. And I said, okay, we have to do something for her. And we were in Lancaster. So I left the conference, ran out to Target, and I bought her a tiara. And so we presented her with this tiara. And the men in the room just thought this was the worst idea we ever had. Why are you giving her a tiara? I said, we'll give you one next year, too. Like, we have to acknowledge that we're not the same as you. And that she was the first female president we had had in a very long time. So we wanted to acknowledge that accomplishment. And I think a lot of times within our associations, right, ICMA is even worse because ICMA, when I first went there, that was all old white guys. I was 31 and it was just all older, middle-aged men. But I think we need to acknowledge our differences and celebrate them. Women aren't the same as men. We don't lead the same. We don't manage the same, right? And we also approach life differently. And so I've sort of been fighting and not fighting, maybe it's not the good word, but advocating with Stephanie and with Stephanie Mason and with all the other women in our association to try to push us forward. Like, we don't have to be from the same mold. We can live out loud, so to speak, and do our jobs out loud. And I think that's what we need to focus on with getting younger women into our profession, right? Is making sure they feel at home and there is a place for them.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Every one of you that's already in the profession, it would really help younger people and people not in the profession if you become advocates, coaches, mentors, anything to promote their well-being and advancement.
Yes, and let's just continue on if you have more, but let's sort of morph this into, since Amy's the idea, and this is really core to why we're here today, that the leadership style or what you bring to leadership now that you are in a position that you're able to express it, what is the difference that maybe you feel or uniqueness? And again, we know and we'll say an assumption we begin with is that there are just all kinds of differences in style, regardless of gender. But we're thinking today about how it has felt to be a woman in a space that hasn't always been welcoming to women.
Well, I'll let the managers speak, but throw out a topic, and that is teamwork. There's a vast literature that shows that women tend to be more oriented toward teamwork in their leadership roles, and that teamwork really pays off because you get better decisions with more inclusion, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe you ought to talk a little bit about that.
Centrice, do you have some ideas about how you think about leadership and how it's influence the way you manage?
Yeah, that's a good question. So how I think about leadership, I think about it in a couple of different ways. I agree with a lot of what Amy said. And then I also have found that a different path is perhaps a little bit more effective for me. So I do have that personality. And if you know me, I really can get a little excited and get a little loud and go up and down. But unfortunately, I haven't always found the best experiences for me to just be authentic every way, all of the time. And so now as a manager of a municipality with the police department, I certainly feel like when I walk into a room to maintain that level of credibility and authority, that there's a version of authenticity that needs to come to the table. So there's that level of trust that's easy to be developed and just everyone has their spidey senses. So I need them to feel that I'm genuine. But I also have to maintain that level of credibility and authority. And so for me, I find that I have to find this level of steadiness. And that can at times be, I wouldn't say a challenge, but it's just something that I keep intentionally at the forefront. I think teamwork is absolutely critical, and collaboration and communication. I oftentimes will find myself providing a lot of information, more than I need to, especially in this position. And recently, during my time as interim, or actually it may have been right after I got appointed, I was asked to approve something. And I said, well, let me give that some thought. And the one response I got was, do you realize the level of authority that you have? And I paused for a minute and I said, of course I do. But just because I can doesn't mean that I should every time. So before I just authorize this, I'm going to give this some thought. And so at that point in time, I realized too that perception of others is quite often their reality. So again, it reinforces for me, sure, I think that we do need to come to the table as women and be very authentic in our leadership, but then also as we manage, understanding that our level of authority is certainly tied to our level of credibility. And while the majority I hear always rooting for this new work-life balance, for this new acceptance of diversity and more women in leadership, the reality is not everyone's actions reflect that message. So maintaining that level of credibility for me is sometimes what I have to prioritize. I have 3 daughters and 1 son. I hope that at their point in time in their career, that they can be more authentic without having their credibility being questioned.
Nicole, I want you to respond. I do wonder how more universal that is for women, this feeling like that your credibility is going to be questioned, and that shapes a little bit how you present. Yeah.
Well, and if you think about local government, they're dealing with a pretty much male-dominant field at Holyoke, the public works department, the police department, by an electric department in my case. You are typically only the only woman in the room. That is typically how it goes. And you have to learn a lot about a lot of things you don't know because you're not brought up in that world. I think we show our passion for work, and then we show our compassion for people. I sincerely care about my people as a manager and in doing what I do now. My people are my number one priority, my staff, my residents. I sincerely care. And that has gotten me into a lot of situations personally with my own feelings because of how much I care. I lead with my heart. My heart guides the process. It's not because I ever had a good mentor. I didn't have a mentor until now in life. My heart guided my process and guided the decisions I would make. My brain would also assist in that process, but the heart definitely guided that. We have that ongoing list in our head. And I think that really helps in our positions because we're constantly creating the list, the to-do list, going through, processing. We do it at home. Does the list ever stop for any of you? It's always going. And I think that's more on the female side of traits. But I think empathy comes more naturally to us. Feeling comes more naturally to us. You want to not show all of your feelings, but I think it's okay to show some of your feelings. And you talked about in the role today, me changing fields at this point, being at the Minor Center, working at Lafayette College, it opens up a whole new element for me that I could create an influence. And I have a sincere concern about our field, as we all should. We need to be developing the next generation. And whether it is a woman or a man, I think we need to be taking that on. I'm here to advocate passionately about the field, and I do that, I think, very well. I generally care, and I'm okay with having a conversation, the difficult conversations. I'm okay with bringing the topics, the pros and the cons to the table. And I'm able to serve as a coach and a guide in this role and be influential in a much bigger way. I also think it's really important with this whole conversation that it's not one size fits all. Mm-hmm. It can go both ways. Your gender doesn't necessarily represent all of this. It can go both ways.
Right. I'm going to pick on Erin a little bit because we've had a little bit of a conversation in the past. And what I'm hearing from Nicole is this really values-based, human-centered heart feel for her profession, for people that she works with. And I'm also hearing from Centrice something I really resonate with, which is how to come across as whether it's authoritative or she uses the word credibility, you're balancing those two. And Erin, I know you have that heart piece. It's so strong in the way you think about the organization. And at the same time, you have been very bold in going forward and saying,
this is an idea I think we need to go for. You've been very much out on the front with some of the projects you've been leading. So when you think about balancing heart with being credible in your presentation, how do you think about that?
Well, I guess one thing that I was saying to some of the staff that I've worked with when I was getting ready to come to this interview, I'm saying I'm struggling because there's a part of me that even today, when I think about women in business, I think about Hillary Clinton, or I think about, maybe you guys know from Rugrats, Angelica's mom, and she's like in this business suit and she's on the phone all the time. She's always yelling at everyone. And she's this feeling of like, to be a woman in leadership, you have to be and hard. And how I was saying that, that's what that characterization comes to my mind when you think of women in business. But really, that's only because I guess other things have put it there. My experience with women in leadership is very much the other way around, that you can be compassionate. And I do see that there is a little bit of change, that there is a wave that allows you to be a compassionate leader, whether you're a man or a woman, and that is appreciated by a team. And that was maybe not something that you could expose, I think, in an earlier generation, because my mom, I think, was very hard. And she was like that because I think she felt like if you expose a little bit, it was going to get smashed. You were going to get crushed. And I think that we've come a little bit ways because you can be soft. And I have an employee who just started about a year ago. And I think he ended up with COVID or something. Ended up with a couple months back. And I called just to say like, hey, how are you feeling? Just wanted to check on you. And I did that with all my employees. But I would imagine he's had many jobs. He's probably in his 50s. And he was like, I've never had an employer call me before just to say like, hey, how are you doing? I wanted to check on you and how you're feeling. And one of the other employees was like, oh yeah, that's what anyone does. And it never occurred to me that was odd or strange. It was just just what you do, because you do care about them. You think about them when you go home. But at the same time, I've seen how difficult it can be in an organization when you let your feelings get in the way of making decisions, and how it disrupts the whole morale of a team, and that you have to have really clear boundaries and really fair guidelines. And that's just it. And you have to say, well, you made your own fate, or I gave you this many choices, this many options, because that's what this policy allows for. And at the end of the day, you have to be able to leave it. So there's a part of it that's like, you can care about somebody, you can want what's best for them, but you can't just keep them hanging on because of some kind of personal situation that they have. Because I have seen that, and it's like a disease at an organization. There's no faster way to alienate the rest of your employees than if you keep a bad actor on too long.
So interesting. And what I hear you saying, though, you should be able to be clear enough to say, this is what I care about. This is the way our organization, the direction we're going. It doesn't mean that you have heart, that you're going to be somehow weak on making clear decisions about the direction you're taking the organization. And maybe continuing along this way, if we get into the research, and I don't know, I did put some research links in the notes for this session. But Bev, you may have some particular areas of research that you want to highlight for us.
Yeah, this is all related to urban management. I found something from ICMA on the underrepresentation of women in just management in general, but leadership. It's really worth just looking out the data. Women mayors, 18.9% of cities, 30,000 or more. And this is recent data. Women, and this is the big one for you guys, in city management, either executives or municipal managers, 19.8%. I think that's data from just a couple years ago. And what I could juxtapose that with is, if you look at higher education today, more women are going to school than men to college. In fact, it's a crisis now to get men, boys into college. More women overwhelmingly in public administration, where you trained a municipal manager. And given all that, you'd think that the numbers would be really high, but it's still only 0.8%. And then other things, women governors, historically only 12%, though I saw this week two states, Massachusetts, got its first female governor and a lieutenant governor that's female, and Arkansas has the governor and the lieutenant governor female. So we're getting more governors just in the last 5 or so years. Lieutenant governors, about 25%. Women in state legislatures, 25%. But, you know, how many women are there in the population? More than 50%. So we're still very low. And then historically, members of Congress, women, 3%. Now, that's totally changing now. We have more senators, around a fourth, a little less than a fourth, than we've ever had. And women in the House are increasing to maybe 20%. But pitiful, especially when you compare those kind of data to other nations. In many other nations, it's 30, 40, 50, even 60, yeah, 65% women in leadership positions. So we're not doing well. And it's the good news is, while an area like ICMA and municipal management was stagnant for about 30 years, the organization itself has created structures and opportunities for women and really is cognizant of the problems to get women in. And there are all kinds of leadership organizations trying to recruit women. So we're getting better, but a lot to do. But the figures are not good.
Right. And when you look at the research globally, I think this is an important point. You can't say that the issues that we have, the pipeline in this country, is because of gender, that women just prefer or make the choice not to go into these roles, because it would mean that their women in America are different from other countries, and we're not different. So there's a specific pipeline issue here that is something different that's happening in other places. And
it's not just government in the U.S. I mean, you could look at the military, airplane pilots, corporate CEOs, all those kinds of things in America, and then add the international comparison.
Right.
It's because the U.S. doesn't have paid maternity leave.
There's
a lot of women who have babies, and trying to juggle all of that is very difficult, and it's very stressful. And I think a lot of people, through no fault of their own, decide that it's too much. I'm going to focus on my kids. And I think it's a shame that people feel like they have to leave the workforce in order to provide that balance. But I think that has a huge part of what it is. And it's,
I think we could find that.
The system doesn't let you be a mom. It's really a big problem.
There must be a correlation there, don't you think, Bev? The correlation
legislation like family leave policy. This is all very relatively new thinking to this country. We have a long way to go. But certainly, there's like work-life balance and mentoring. As I said before, in the history of this country, these are new words and new concerns that were just coalescing around. And I personally think that the people that are most affected, the women, have to be the leaders there, because you get the brunt of, you get the implications and the outcomes of it all. So you have to be the leaders in shaping the solutions.
Yeah,
I would agree with you. But if the decision makers are not in leadership roles, identifying as women and understanding these levels of experiences, that's going to likely delay, if not impart the reason with the delay in legislation.
Yeah. A couple states in have the state ICMA affiliates have major projects on women and the whole ball of wax to help women. I think Ohio is one of those states. Michigan is getting up there. North Carolina has long been interested. Georgia's been interested. California. But the professional organization can really be helpful.
And that's actually one of the things I'm working on with APMM right now. I'm heading up the new promotions committee. And the whole idea is to promote local government as a career, but also to promote local government as a career to women and to people of color, because our profession needs a rainbow, frankly, in the middle of it. And our profession, our communities should look like, our government should look like the communities that we serve, right? And it doesn't right now. I'm fortunate. I'm the third female manager we've had in Harris Township. We had one in the 70s and then the one right before me. But it's not, Centrice is the first in Ferguson Township, and we're literally next door neighbors. State College has never had a female manager. College Township, Patton Township, they've never had female managers. And I think some of it is, it was always sold that this was a man's job. You had to worry about paving roads and doing a budget, and that's not real attractive. And when I was going through my MPA at Penn State Harrisburg, there were a lot of people that came into it to get an MPA to go out and work for a nonprofit. And nonprofits were where it was at because you could go and it was not as rigid as being in government or whatever. And I think part of the issue now is I think we need to tell people what this job is. Like, I do a lot of community engagement. It's community development. It's not just worrying that the roads are getting plowed and paved and that the budget's being done, right? That there are other ways that make this a very exciting career path and a way to have an impact in the world. And I don't think that story gets told. And then you add on top of it that you have women that want to be mothers and that want to have families and spouses and things. And it's very hard to do that in this position with the way things are now. You have to have an organization that is supportive and that understands that you need a work-life balance and that understands that if your child is sick and it's meeting night, you might have to Zoom into the meeting so you can be home with your child. I think things are changing. I think the pandemic forced some things to change, which is great, but change is very slow to come. Again, when I was at Penn State Harrisburg, my MPA, I did a whole paper on women in local government and women in government. And at the time, 2001, it was only 11% city managers were female. And the research that I found was that women typically, they would go to the top of the agencies that were seen as female driven. So education and arts related things in libraries. And they weren't heads of transportation and they weren't governors or lieutenant governors. We have to change that perception.
Yeah, the current literature on women in municipal management also is that they tend to only apply for the smaller local government jobs and don't go much for the big jobs, either county government or municipal government, and also take longer to apply for any movement up than men. They seem to be more perfectionist kind of thing. But one thing about the point you were making, Amy, is municipal management grew out of engineering. I mean, the original city managers were engineers. So it's taken decades and decades and decades to change that. And certainly the responsibilities are growing. And the thing that's the real push for people wanting to go into local government these days is one-on-one interaction service at the local level. I had the delightful opportunity last weekend to go back to my alma mater. They have a scholarship endowment. I'm on their board of trustees, but one part of it was giving scholarships. And my brother and I set up a fund for the political science department. And so I got to be with the student that got the scholarship this year and her family. And the first thing that I ask her is, what, other than her major, what did she want to do? She wants to be a municipal manager. And I said, why?
Congratulations. She said,
just for years, since I was a little kid, I like the idea of government, one-on-one interaction, and delivering services and engaging people. I couldn't believe it. Like, my dream is that I met the student. But then in talking with her, she had, even though there's career services and professors and everything, she really doesn't have a clue as to where to go to try to get a first position, like as an assistant manager or something in local government. She wants to start out and then get a master's degree, like work in Pittsburgh and get a master's maybe at Pitt or something like that. So I told her I'd help her. But it was so delightful because I said, what help did you get in deciding? No help. She, from just a kid growing up, just fell in love with local government.
Awesome. Hey, I can touch on the pipeline issue somewhat just because of the nature of what some of my role is here with the Minor Center. But before doing so, you were talking about being a woman in the field and being a manager and being a mother. And again, I became a mother later in my life and later in my career. And I can tell you the stress levels increased tenfold. I felt things that I had never felt in my entire career within that first year of my daughter's life in that job. And I felt in a lot of moments that the two positions were not conducive to each other. That being a mother and being a manager and the burdens that you carry for your home and the community, it was a lot. And I definitely saw the shift and I saw the stress levels increase so much. So I think that the other side of it is your meetings all the time. You're not home. I think about the managers in your life who will say, like, all of my kids' pictures, I'm not in any of them because they were in a meeting. And that is very difficult to do as a mother, to find that balance or to, it is very difficult. The pipeline issue, one of our services that we provide here at the Minor Center is recruitments and searches for managers, chiefs, finance directors. And in every search, there are more male applicants every time than there are female applicants. And then when you get into the interviews, there is a difference in how we interview also. There's even a difference in getting ready for the interview and prepping the appearance. Think about the time that you would spend to prep for an interview, your dress, your makeup, your hair to go into an interview. You're prepping much more. You're putting more time into that, your efforts, and also see more. During the interview process, you will see more personality come from a woman than you will from a man. They will showcase their personality more. And I don't know the reason for that, but you definitely will see it. But there is no doubt that the amount of women applying for these jobs are much less than the amount of male applicants.
Yeah, I think a pipeline issue is really critical. And this reminds me of coming up through the consulting world, and I was in a consulting firm with a lot of men. And I remember at that very outset, I'm watching men that don't have the experience or the education that I have that are getting put right into the consulting role because they had maybe something to Nicole's point. There was something just the way they conducted themselves that I suppose was thought they're just going to be able to be a sponge and go right in there and fit into the client world. Whereas I had to adapt. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the characteristics I think is very important with women leaders is that we understand how much we adapt. Not that we need to adapt. I think I was probably a person that was really trying to adapt to this men's world. And I think, but also I was very insistent on being human-centered. That was the part of me I brought from my upbringing. I was very human-centered and I was always insisting on collaboration. I wasn't going to be this directive, top-down sort of person. And I think the pipeline means it leads into my last question. We need to do a better job of saying, hey, when you're starting out, regardless of your gender, you're going to be rough around the edges. Every one of us needs development to say, well, I don't think she has it, but oh, I know this guy, he'll be fine. That there is sort of this natural assumption that somehow we need to change the woman to be somehow different. And I know that's presumptuous to say that. That's not always the case. But I do think the pipeline means that we're overlooking possible candidates because we think, oh, they won't be quite as good a fit. Now that we have local government being so much more human-centered, I think, more community-centered, more focus on the residents, on the community connections, I think that we are natural as our sort of native skills of holding the family together, all the things that come with us in our roles that we, not the men don't have that. I just think that the research does show with empathy and some of the traits that come through more so with women, mainly being human-centered and willing to be vulnerable. I think that there's a shift, a major shift going on right now. So I think that pipeline should be better, but maybe to Aaron's point, and the last question really is, what is the conversation that we want to bring men into? And I think the one about family support, whether it's, I don't know how you would frame it, but it has to do with saying if you're bringing somebody up through and you want them to be a leader in your organization or you want to support them in this professional growth, it's going to require support. And not that men shouldn't also be. This is something they've done in other countries, experimented with. If you give men leave too, it's not necessarily that they're always going to take it. But anyway, we could talk about that. Like what do we need to have that conversation to bring men into a conversation about really building up this pipeline so that there are more women in our profession?
I think that men in general need to understand that women are not men. and that we manage differently. We are different leaders. We have different ways that we respond to things. And I think about times that some of the male managers up here have said to me, oh, you're just a little too familiar with your elected officials. You're just a little too familiar with your staff. You're just a little too this. I'm not too this. I'm who I am, right? And when I think taking some of the bias out of it too, right? When I became APMM president, so the way you become president, you have to be the conference chair. You become the conference chair by getting to the person who's going to be the conference chair in your region before you and asking them if you could be their conference chair. So in my case, that was Tom Verneau. I went to Tom in 2014 and I said, Tom, I used to like literally run a professional conference at my last job. I would really like to be your conference chair and be president. And Tom made a handshake deal with me and said, okay, we'll do it. So in 2018, I was getting ready to be the conference chair for 2019. And he called me up and he said, I had a concern expressed to me, and it was by somebody else within the APMM membership, not the organization, that you have too big of a personality, that you're using this as a stepping stone, that you don't take your career seriously, and that you won't be a good president. And I said, well, I would love to know who said all those things because they're not true at all. And he goes, I didn't believe it. I'm not changing my answer. You're still going to be my conference chair and be president. I later found out who that person was. I will not say who that person was, but I had a meeting with that person when I was president who was trying to get me then to do all kinds of favors for this person. And I thought to myself, you looked at me and you saw me not as a capable manager and a capable president of your professional organization, but you saw me as less than because of all the things that make me who I am. And that putting that bias into that really impedes getting more women to be president of our association. It shouldn't be a good old boys network where you go and you have to make a backdoor deal. It should be that I'm selected because of my merit and because I have something that I want to give to the organization. In a manager's job, the manager that the young woman that Bev talked about that wants to be a municipal manager, I'd love to talk with her and help her get connected through the Western PA managers and get her an assistant manager job and let her work up. We're better and we're the best when we're helping each other. Centrice and I live that in the center region. Centrice and I reach out to each other when we need help. Centrice has been killing it the first 9 months as manager. I have to say that. She's had a lot thrown in her lap and she's been awesome. But we reach out to each other. There's no competition between us. And I think for whatever reason, men think that women are catty and there's going to be a competition. It's not. It's not at all. We have to have the conversation with them and show them that we can be leaders and that we can run organizations and we can run towns and cities.
And I love that.
So I first just want to say thank you, Amy, for those kind words. And I agree with everything that Amy said. I think Amy broke it down and really highlighted some things. And I want to give a response to that. But before I do, I just want to touch on something that might be a little controversial, but nothing too difficult to discuss. But I just want to suggest that while I think bringing men into a conversation is so important, I also don't want to deny the fact that there are women, too, that I think that could participate in this conversation. And I'll even go as far as to say that my observations and experiences would suggest that there are certain men and women that could be brought into this conversation, because when you think about some of those that are older and in leadership roles, particularly men, and you think about how they were raised, some of their counterparts, it's based on childhood upbringing and philosophies and foundations. So I have experienced at times, depending on certain spaces, some of the women actually bringing far more barriers than men, really rooted in some of these beliefs of what the workplace should be like, right? And sometimes if you have a very dominant female in the workplace that has working for a male who's had these philosophies and believing that women are in more secretarial role, well, that female under that type of leadership for 20 plus years can now become the same level of obstacle or barrier as the man. So I just want to acknowledge that while I would love to bring men into the conversation, I wouldn't suggest that it's only men. But I would also say this too, to bring men and women into a conversation, I would want to just have a little bit more dialogue about acceptance. So we talk a lot about women and we talk a lot about people of color, but we don't talk about some of the easiest ways that we can just, you know, really expand this diversity that we want to see in the workplace. And It doesn't just start by looking through applicants that we think might bring some level of diversity. It starts with really starting to integrate this new culture into your workplace, having conversations that might talk a little bit more about children and not allowing other people to say, oh my gosh, like she's just talking about her children. I'm done hearing about that. But being more accepting that there's more to some conversation, even in the workplace, than the Phillies that played, right? And no offense to the sport fans here on this call, but like, the game that was played is equally interesting as the playground that I took my child to, depending on those that are sitting in the room. And I just think having those conversations, accepting these different personalities, bold, timid, understanding that everyone has a role in the workplace and cultivating or allowing the conversations on the side. And of course, I say not allowing it. Of course, you can't stop somebody, but really building up and demonstrating the behaviors that we want to see. When I see somebody with a big personality, I try really hard to just say, I really love that about that person and praising that personality. So people understand that just because I don't show up that way doesn't mean that I don't appreciate the energy that that individual brings into the room. And then, of course, I said it at the introduction here, I will oftentimes intentionally inject some of my background experiences because they are so different than other people. And I think about the person that might apply or walk through these doors here at Ferguson Township that might just be applying, not because they have this idea in their head they want to be the next manager or the next director. In fact, they might be coming with a little bit of shame and embarrassment because their childhood is so different and they already feel when they walk through the doors that maybe they're not going to be the one. They already believe that they're not the one to be sitting at the table. And so to change that, I think we have to start having conversations. And oftentimes people that are divorced, you don't hear them ever, they hide it. And not that I'm saying we should talk about divorce. I'm just saying if you want an inclusive environment, then it's more than just saying men need to do this. It's about all of us should be really talking a little bit more about having these conversations and acceptance of different personalities that support a workplace where people say, yeah, we all have different backgrounds, but we're accepting of the differences that we all bring to the table.
I think one of the things that I've noticed is, so Lower Allen will say we have trouble getting in applicants that are diverse. Or we don't look at color. We're just going to hire the person who's best for the job. And particularly, we know that our cops are supposed to have a force that reflects the community. And it occurs to me like, well, but there's differences in opportunities. So yes, you're going to get people who have degrees in criminal justice. And that is your view that is what's going to make a good cop. And you have other people who aren't going to have that kind of background. And so they're automatically then not as qualified. But like, but they also maybe lived in the community for a lot longer. They have different ties. And we don't tend to rate those the same way. So I guess I feel like in some ways, the standards of how people get judged still feels very much to me like old school standards. Do you know what I mean? Like we haven't really come into a round and say, yes, but because this person doesn't have that type of background, it's going to round us out. It's going to give us a chance to have somebody who has a different perspective to say, yes, but you didn't think of it this way. Because you can be, I think, as empathetic as you want, but if you haven't been in situations, it's really hard to realize how people are feeling. And here's one of my examples is, so when I came back and I was breastfeeding, but you're going to all kinds of meetings or whatever, and you have to get up, you have to pump. First of all, you hate pumping anyways, because it's a constant reminder that, oh, you're not with this child. You're not doing what you should naturally be doing. So it's hard and you're sad. It's like a whole thing. But you're also in the middle of this meeting and you don't want to like walk out. So you're waiting and people are droning on and you're becoming more and more uncomfortable. And finally, you just kind of get up and leave. And that's what I would do at some of our meetings. And someone would always say like, well, where are you going? And I always, to me, because I was, I think, sensitive at that time in my life, felt like, what a jerk. Like, why would they call me out in the middle of a meeting like that? That is just so awful. And this place is so chauvinistic and they don't get it at all. And then when you are a little bit past that time of your life and you can look back, you're like, oh, but also I was just getting up and walking out of their meeting. But you can't. Like, which, so from their perspective was probably like, it, kind of rude there, Erin. So it wasn't that either of us, I think, were necessarily wrong, but it was just that you miss, right? Because your perspective has blinded you to what the situation actually is. And I think that that is still really true. And I see that a lot, I think, from men, women, whatever, about being women in the workplace. I see the Me Too movement is still here. So there's still intentional things, but I see a lot of just ignorance is, I guess, what I would say is just ignorance to the situation. A lot of my coworkers, their wives didn't work and their kids are my age and I'm still working with them. And I'm sorry, but I can't be here till 8:30 because the school doesn't start till 8:15 and there's no childcare anymore because they got rid of it during COVID because most of the people decided, oh, I can work from home. I'll just take them. And so you're like, you want me here? This is when I can show up. And you feel a little bad about that, but also you're like, this is the situation. This is, you got to meet me at where I am. And I think my work has, but there's also a lot of like, well, I don't understand that. My wife got the kids on the school bus. They just don't understand the kind of what you're juggling or how much you're taking on because that wasn't their experience. And it's not, I think, intentionally mean. It's just missing. It's just a missing perspective. And I don't know how you start to really integrate all of that. So and I love when there's men dads in my work now that have like younger kids. It sometimes helps kind of soften the conversation.
Or men who have daughters that are starting to raise families and they want their daughters to have a profession. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we're broadening this conversation. And I feel like you're hitting on what Centrice was actually saying in the dialogue about acceptance. And I do think there's a moment now that we have met that says, we really can work from home. So a professional, and you see this in some corporations, there's women who have kids and they say, well, I'm going to take some time off. And the CEO comes back and says, we'll do anything. What do you need? Do you need 2 days off a week? Do you need, like, they're just thinking about how valuable this person is, which is the way we should be thinking. If we've got a person who's really valuable, then we're going to work around to try to make sure they can integrate and do what they do best. And that's going to look different in every situation. But the acceptance is saying some people have different needs. Some people come that they've got great qualities to bring to this organization, but maybe they need this development piece over here. Mm-hmm. All of that is under that expansion of diversity. And I'm just wondering who comes to the conversation receptive to other perspectives and maybe can bring some perspectives to the conversation that would also be helpful to women to hear, because I think men have there's a lot of great perspectives out there that they may feel there's barriers that they're not able to get past. It would be interesting to hear that as well. I'm not sure every man's right for that conversation.
I'll jump in because I think it follows up with all three of you and everything you're saying. I think whether you're male or whether you're a female, to be able to show your feelings, to be able to show your human side, to be able to show that you care is just so important. It doesn't matter what gender you are. You need to be able to show that you care and that people matter. Like whether you're a male or a female, your core values are probably the same. It's a matter of how you go about showing them. And again, it's just all three of you are talking about really feelings there. It's important to be able to show that. And I think that women are better at showing our feelings. And that can help in the time of a crisis because you're more relatable. You're showing that human side. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's in the research too that I was reading. I noted that women are judged to be better leaders in a crisis.
Yeah, just patience, tolerance, and understanding as a whole for people is just so important. And just care.
Yeah. Yeah. But we have touched on so much here, and I think we're going to need to bring this to the close. I respect your time. But again, this thinking about if we were to really bring in some diverse voices about how we can sort of expand the way we think about not just gender, but all different kinds of ethnicity, age, all of the kinds of ways that we have this imprint of how we have done things in the past, or maybe we have suspicions that that's the way it's still done. And if we want to think about really building up a pipeline that of professionals, what exactly needs to happen? And this is a question I think about all the time with my clients. What really needs to happen here?
I think it's really important that for the local government side of things, that we that we start looking at how do we recruit and retain, and what do we take from the private sector that can be incorporated, because otherwise there's no competition.
Yeah.
So if the being able to work from home, being able to have some sort of balance, being able to be empowered and trusted, respected, because like we talk about the work from home stuff, that is just like something local government. I don't know about you, but during COVID, were you in your office? I was in my office every day. There was not a point in time where I was not there. That was not an option to work from home. And we've learned we can, and it needs to be promoted in the field. Also, a four-day work week, wouldn't that be nice? Like looking at those concepts and bringing them into the field and just adapting. Yes, you can get it done in 4 days. Yeah. That's okay. There's just, we need to start incorporating these ideas.
Would women be more likely to develop some creative workplaces? Amy, would you be open to talking about other ways to non-traditional workplaces? Let me put it in that.
Yeah, absolutely. During COVID, I sent my staff home. There's only 8 of us, right? So my public works guys couldn't do anything. So I paid them to come in once a day and travel around and look at our roads, make sure everything was okay. I sent my office staff to work from home, and it worked very well. I was the only one that was in the office, and that's because I would have gone crazy if I was in my house by myself. But yeah, no, I think we do need to look at, but the flip side of that has always been, we have forward-facing jobs. My public works crew can't work from home, right? They have to go out and take care of storm drains and pave and things. My office staff, someone has to be here to deal with the public. So we have to look at how we can fit some of that creativity and that balance within the structure of, we work for the public. And some of us have communities with older folks typically who say, I pay your salary, you work for me. And so how do you balance that? College Township looked at a 4-day work week probably 10 years ago, and their manager was almost, he was lambasted in the press about it, because you couldn't believe you're getting these lazy local government workers 4 days. And now it's a very much a part of the conversation in the private sector. So I think everything Nicole said is right. We have to think about creativity. Also, I think as managers have to make our staffs feel like they're contributing to something greater than themselves and make them feel like they're part of a team. And that's something I try to do here. And in looking at getting people in that pipeline, we need to look at what the impediments are. Like, we need to have a conversation as to why people don't want to be local government. Is it because the public has gotten a little nastier after everything that's gone on the last couple of years? Is it because the time constraints, because they want to have a family and it's hard if you have night meetings to have kids who are doing things? Are there other reasons? And then we need to look for that flexibility and start addressing it. And I don't think it, and I think what Centrice said is right too, it's about embracing everybody, right? It's not about, oh, we're going to send out and we're going to get resumes back that don't have first names on it, which I understand. I get that that takes out, you don't know the gender of the person or whatever, but we need to get to the place where we're looking truly at the qualifications of the person. And if we're going to say this person can do this job, but they need some accommodations, so let's make those accommodations for them. Let's make this a more welcoming environment for everybody. The comment is great. We live in State College, right? So all we do is talk about Penn State football up here. Centrice is right. I like to hear about my employees' families too. I don't need to talk about sports ball all the time. I like sports ball, but I like to talk about family. Centrice is absolutely right. Making that conversation in the office just more inclusive for everybody.
Thank you, Amy. I think we have time for just some quick last reflections. Bev, I'll start with you. Any last reflections on the thoughts today that you've been hearing?
Yeah, back to bringing men into the conversation.
Yeah.
I think it would be important to have a conversation, a mixed conversation, men and women, with, are there any perceptions that women in management have a value added to the organization? We've touched on it a little bit. Someone mentioned empathy at length, teamwork was mentioned, collaboration, crisis management, really important. There's a big literature that women are called in when there's a financial crisis. Women managers tend to be hired and used. But I think that would be good. And then the other one, I could talk about others, but another one is, I think what managers in Pennsylvania ought to do is not focus so much on college students in public admin programs, though that's important. I think you have to get down to the high school level because there's a lack of civic education. People don't know what the opportunities are, the excitement of the one-on-one interaction with local government. So that's what I wish the managers would do.
That's good. Good. Thank you. Nicole, how about you? Last thoughts.
I just think the ability to lead, to influence, to motivate, enable. Again, I don't think that's a gender, that's not gender related. Maybe we do things a little bit differently. Maybe we do things a little bit better. But to be a leader, you have to understand your people. You have to care about your people. And you have to be able to empower them. So that's not a gender topic. It's a topic in whole. And the reality is for local government, we have to be creative. We have to be looking at high school level students. We have to be looking at people who are outside of our world to bring them in because we don't have a choice. We don't have the candidates to fill these spots. The amount of times that my phone rings for searches because of changes, it's crazy. And there's just not the people to be filling the spots that are open. So we need to be empowering everybody and encouraging them to love the field, have the passion for the field.
It might be a gender topic if from the perspective of something Amy brought up earlier about public engagement. It may be that female managers are more receptive to a greater variety of public engagement ways of doing things. It would be interesting to explore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's good. Erin, how about you? Any last thoughts?
I don't know. We touched on a lot here. You need anything to kind of round this out?
Yeah. I really do think that there is an importance around understanding where men see barriers, because I think that is important for us to hear and understand. And I work with managers all the time, revere their women staff, you being one of them, Erin, and Centris being another one. Like, I have been in scenarios where I hear how great the women are. So I have a real high regard for men that recognize these skills. And I'd like to know where they see barriers for people coming up through the pipeline and getting a better sense of that for us to sort of zoom in on.
And I asked my husband, I said, well, I was like, let me ask you this. I was like, can you name women that influence you in leadership and influence you in your career choices? And he's a teacher at a high school. And he said, no, I can't think of anyone. And I was like, your mom is a teacher. Like, your mom is a teacher. Your sister is a teacher. Like, and he was like, oh yeah. I'm like, this right here is the whole problem that, like, men, women are very much expected to be able to say men, women, they always influence you. And I feel like there's still a hesitancy for men to be able to say, I was influenced by this woman. This helped me make my decision. And maybe it's just because we're still kind of coming into those roles. But the other thing I think that I always want to recognize is that you don't have to be in a position of power to be a leader. And I think that is a story of women across centuries. And it doesn't get really told that there's very much a soft side of leadership and a support role that is also being a leader. And for whatever reason, we tend to only think of the leaders being the person out front. And I think maybe women are only now really getting to be more the people out front, but I think they've always been leaders, is what I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a shifting world in terms of what the needs are at the workplace. So there is, I think, more femininity, if you want to put it in those terms, that is more acceptable and needed.
There's times that softness is required. You have to be soft.
Yeah, it's starting to be more recognized as part of the ingredients. Centris, I'm just kind of working my way around the screen here. Any last thoughts before we go? Not today.
Yeah, Erin, I was really thinking about your question to your husband, and I asked my husband something similar. He's the associate director for transportation services at Penn State, and he's constantly hiring. He's a huge staff, and he has really expanded diversity when he worked for the State College Borough in the parking department and also at the transportation services. And I'm always just curious. He comes from a small southern town in Tennessee and grew up on a Christmas tree farm, right? So he wasn't born into and around a lot of diversity, but it's something that I notice every time I walk into an office that he manages, I see a change. And so I asked him the same question and he just said, I don't know. I just look at their skills and their background. And sometimes it's just lost on me how some applicants get overlooked. Their credentials are sometimes even considered to be overqualified, right? And he's like, I'll hire anyone with any last name if their credentials show that they're the right person. And we talked as we unpacked that conversation a little bit more about how sometimes some folks will still focus on the fit. And a little bit more of a priority gets placed on, will this person fit in? Will this person even want to work in this condition? And how the conversation in a very subtle way can just start to take many shapes. And before you realize it, the bias or the unbiased or implicit bias has dominated the entire conversation without anyone ever having to acknowledge that there were other attributes or characteristics of the applicant. And so I think for me, it's talking a little bit more about individuals, right? I know we prioritize men and women, but or men versus women, but just exploring if individuals in these leadership roles that are in the position to start bringing in more women into executive positions, are they aware of their bias? Are they aware about their implicit bias? We all have it. And if we don't talk a little bit more about our implicit bias, and even though it's very uncomfortable, right? If we don't talk more about it, then how can that ever get addressed? I could talk to you about a lot of different strategies, but none of it matters if the people that are making the final decisions have this implicit bias that they're either unaware of or somehow really are able to avoid that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. I think implicit bias would be a great topic for one whole conversation. Just having a conversation around it, I think it really raises awareness of experiences, personal experiences of how that shows up. Amy, last but not least, what would you like to add to the final?
Well, I think I've said a lot today, but I think this has been a fantastic conversation. Yeah. And I think that we need to continue this conversation, right? And I appreciate that we need to bring men into it and also women. I appreciate what was said about there are some women that need to have this conversation as well. Yeah. I think all the talking we do is great, but we need to put some concrete action in place to try to get that pipeline built up to get people moving forward. I like the conversation about implicit bias because I think there are people that will tell you they don't have any implicit bias and they're not having the self-awareness that they need to have to see, and they don't understand the role that they play within their organization and how that implicit bias plays into that. So I would love to see more conversations around this topic. I would love to see more conversations and more action. I would love to sit here a year from now and say, we've got a concrete plan for Pennsylvania and we've engaged all these folks and we have a diverse background and we're working really hard to get people into local government and filling these positions. But that only happens if we get people engaged enough to want to move forward on this. And it goes beyond the people that are on this call today, this podcast today, and into getting more people to understand and see. And also when we're talking about getting men involved, it's not just the younger managers, right? It's also some of our retired colleagues. We had a colleague in Patton Township for years, Tom Kurtz. Tom Kurtz was a great champion for women in local government. Tom Kurtz is probably my number two mentor, my number one mentor being Pete Whipple. But Tom wants to see women advance in local government. And to this day, comes into State College once a year, gives me a call, we go for coffee and have these fantastic conversations about my career and where I want to go. And he gives great advice. And it's tapping into that network of the retired managers who can sort of help drive this conversation as well. Because people like Tom, people like Ron Wegeman, people like Larry Communell, they were doing this before anybody talked about this, before anybody said this was something we needed to be working on. So I think tapping into that, and I think we all understand the urgency because we have this gray tsunami that's coming, the gray wave, and we have so many people retiring, and it's a great opportunity to help build that pipeline and get people moving through as assistants, as managers, and change the landscape of our profession.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't have asked a more talented, insightful group to come together today. I am just so thrilled that you said yes and that we were all able to be here. And I do like this idea of continuing the conversation. And I invite you, as well as the listeners to this podcast, to think about how you would frame, and there can be several different conversations we can have, but how to frame the one that you think might be a good one for another podcast episode. Implicit bias maybe is a whole episode. But I invite you to give me those ideas. And I just wanted to send you off just with a huge thank you. And you're all awesome. And I'm just really excited to be able to be here with you today. So thank you so much. Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you. Yeah,
we'll thank you.
Thanks for staying on.